This title for the talk I came up with before I came here, and then I found out more about that title, which has been a popular phrase, the It Takes a Village title that Sister Rosina has told us is actually a Ghanaian phrase. And she told us the entire longer title. It's basically before the child is born, it belongs to the mother, or the mother and father. And after the child is born, it belongs to the entire community, and so it takes an entire village to raise a child. But we moved that into a forum the other night in which we did talk about whose responsibility it is to raise a child, and I think all of us recognize that the primary responsibility for raising children comes from parents, but that nobody can do everything in terms of raising children, and some parents do little or nothing to raise children, and on top of that, some actually do things that are harmful rather than helpful to raising a child. And we have two choices as a public, not meaning as a government, but as a community, as a public. We have two choices. One is to say, well, tough luck, kid, you're on your own. Or no, we're going to step in and somehow or another fill that gap, whether it's from other institutions or government or somewhere along the line, we're going to fill the gap. And watching outside with the bubbles and everybody playing there, this is the kind of village where you don't need somebody to be assigned to fill the gap. People just tend to do it on their own and step in. But I would suggest that the answer is clearly not to say tough luck, kid, but that we do have two reasons for investing in children, one of which is the moral responsibility. It's not, we legally and morally do not expect children to take care of themselves. When people complain about welfare recipients who are lazy, I don't think we expect 5 or 10-year-old kids to be self-supporting. And if their parents aren't, it's not the kid's fault. And legally, we treat it that way. I think morally, we feel an obligation to help out, to step in where there are gaps, to intervene where there are problems. The second one is the self-interest of a society or a community. If you look at the profile of any cold-blooded killer, I remember a particularly moving profile of a particularly brutal person, a Californian who was, I believe, several years ago executed for having murdered 2 kids at a fast food restaurant, and then after he murdered them, he finished their hamburgers. And some columnist in Los Angeles Times wrote a beautiful piece on what created this monster of a person. And it talked about how he was born prematurely when his father, who was drunk, kicked his mother and she fell backwards into the bathtub and she delivered early. And how the father thought that this kid was an illegitimate child or somebody else's child, and so he was particularly brutal to him. Anytime the kid would reach for something at the table, his father's fork would be stabbing in the back of the hand. He said by the time he was 5, he was killing animals. By the time he was 6, he had been chemically dependent on from glue and all kinds of substances. And it said, you know, we can see when this happens, the court transcripts talking about what the child went through when he was going there. It's not a surprise what he went through. You talk to Martha, you say you're a kindergarten teacher. Most kindergarten, first grade teachers can point out kids who are going to have troubles, who aren't going to make it.
Especially in the neighborhood I teach in. I teach in one of the lower socioeconomic areas of Las Vegas, across the street from public housing. We've had to put gates up around the chicken wire fences up around the school because of shots fired on campus this past year.
Mm-hmm.
I have kids who think 911 is what you do on the weekends. It's not a TV show. And I can tell you very much which are the kids who aren't going to make it to 5th grade, who aren't going to make it to be a teenager.
And we basically, as a society, say, I mean, we try and keep them in school, but we don't do anything else to intervene at that time, and we're in effect surrendering to the kids. And
if some of our kids, 5, hitting them in kindergarten for some of them is too late.
Yeah.
I've got kids who, it's too late to do anything with them at this point.
And the newest thinking, I mean, they're talking about the earliest weeks of life being the most critical. And certainly preschool programs, mm-hmm. head start and everything, people are saying, look, you know, at 4 or 5, it would be nice if we start at 1 or 2. And basically birth to 3 would be the most valuable time. Mm-hmm. But that's a part of the investment. Once you get to the 5-year-olds who are in deep trouble, no matter what you do, they're still not going to be as healthy as if we had started at birth. But we have the choice of, do we try and intervene further at that point, or we say, well, you know, the kid's hopeless. I say giving up on a 5-year-old before they're halfway through their childhood is not acceptable. But it's not just the crime aspect. There are every other reason we want to give kids a chance. And I would suggest that the way we ought to look at this is, again, from those two aspects on why we ought to do it. One is our moral responsibility to children, and the second one is our social and community self-interest. I like the phrase, I know it may be overused, but the ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. There's a lot of wisdom in it. You put in some effort to prevent a problem and it gets better. We talk heavily about preventive health and how exercising and eating right is a lot cheaper than ignoring those things and going in for heart bypass surgery. And the same thing is true with healthcare, with crime prevention. I like to suggest that the ounce of prevention makes sense in terms of healthcare, education costs, crime costs, the whole range of elements that we have to face as a society and that government eventually picks up the tab for. Those are all things that early investments make a difference. I know, to take a couple examples of that, the Women, Infant, Children Nutrition Program, which is a 20-some-year-old federal nutrition program where it qualifies low-income pregnant women and mothers of 0 to 3 or 4 year olds, gives them access to low-income people access to nutritious food. A lot of milk, dairy products, eggs, grapefruit, certain foods that are particularly valuable to pregnant women and young children. And studies over the years have suggested, in terms of healthcare costs and education costs, because of more adequate brain development, which is so critical in fetal stages plus early childhood, that you save about $3 for every dollar you invest in it. And of course, I can throw out those numbers and somebody goes, I don't believe those numbers. There have been a number of studies that have said that, and having seen evidence of it, I'm pretty persuaded by that, some may not. If we got a dollar payback for every dollar invested in it, it would be not a loss to be doing it. But did they claim the program over numerous years has suggested about 3-to-1 savings? Yet I know in Minnesota, where we have a subsidy to the federal program to tack on, there's about half the children who are income eligible, half the families, who do not get services under the WIC program. And there is some parenting education and other things along the way, nutrition education, which is so critical because just giving them something they don't know how to use is not helpful. In the crime prevention area, I remember about 3, 4, or 5 years ago, there are 4 counties in California. The first of them was, I believe, Ventura County. I don't even know where it is. I just did study the program some. And they took juvenile offenders, kids who had been in serious offenses, and they started taking those kids and screening them for mental health and chemical dependency needs. And not surprisingly, chemical dependency does not mean a kid, a person, adult, anyone, is going to commit crimes. There are many chemically dependent people who do nothing illegal. And same thing with mental health. Mental health problems are in no way any indicator of somebody's involvement in illegal activities, but there are a certain number of people with mental health problems that the higher percentage perhaps are going to be having problems with that. And when you see the number of kids who have these things, and Ventura County started taking kids as soon as they were arrested and going through the court system, and they started screening them. They'd have some meetings with people who could evaluate them, and then as they found a need, they'd intervene. Perhaps intensive family intervention, perhaps chemical dependency treatments, perhaps if there was some mental health problem, they might be able to help in that regard. And by addressing all of these things, they found out they cut the recidivism, the repeat offense rate, by these serious juvenile offenders, the kids who were in institutions, who were taken out of their homes, and cut the repeat offense rate by half. Now here we go agonizing about what we can do to keep the crime rate from rising. And actually we've had some good news in recent years where, not totally understood by everyone why, but there have been some reductions in crime rates in many parts of the country, which is good news. Could be demographic, could be many other things. But I don't think saying that keeping the crime rate about where it is, or slight reductions, or slight or slow increase is acceptable. I think most of us would like to see our society far safer. And if you have an indication like these counties in California did, that you could take serious juvenile offenders and intervene and cut the rate in half, boy, that's a big step in the right direction. And again, Martha, when you were saying before that 5-year-olds, for many of those kids, it's too late. Well, 12 and 15 and 18-year-old, it's far later. And yet, do you surrender there and wait till they come and murder somebody and you lock them up for the rest of their life? Or do you intervene then? And I'd suggest you, when you've got a serious juvenile offender, you intervene then if you haven't already done something early on. And certainly kindergarten would be better than then, and 2 years old might have prevented it, the whole thing in the first place. But that's one more example. And then finally, there was a big study came out in 1994. It was, since I was doing a lot of talk about prevention investments during the gubernatorial campaign in 94, I was very pleased to see a study. I think the newspaper accounts of it called it the most detailed, in-depth study of chemical dependency costs and treatments and so on in the country. And it was, again, a California study. This one, it was on investments California made in chemical dependency, alcohol and drug treatment programs. And their chemical dependency is not an exact science. We don't know how to solve chemical dependency problems. We have some success in various types of treatment programs, but still, depending on how good the programs are and the type of addiction we're trying to deal with, there may be half or more than half who fail. But this massive study that was funded by a foundation, I don't know, maybe it was Rand Corporation, I can't think of who had funded the study, but it was an independent group who was assessing what California did. And they found out from 1991 expenditures in California, government expenditures on chemical dependency, they were saving $7, I think it was like $1.5 billion in two areas combined, healthcare and crime reduction. And I've worked heavily on DWI issues, drunk driving issues in Minnesota, and it's amazing how many offenders, people have chemical dependency problems. In Minnesota, our laws are strict enough that if you do it because you're careless and you don't pay attention to such things, you're gonna get a DWI. And then once you've been arrested once, it's more than a slap on the wrist now. It's very expensive, very painful process to go through. Many of the counties, you'll serve a weekend in jail, which for most people is a big shock. And the expense and everything else it does to you, you're not going to have a second offense unless you've got some pretty serious problems with alcohol. And yet, we have majority of our repeat DWI offenders have never been screened in a formal process for chemical dependency. And many times the courts order them into treatment, alcohol treatment, but often what treatment counts as is the 12-step program, Alcoholics Anonymous or something, which is very valuable, I think very much of them, but it's not an initial treatment program for somebody who really needs perhaps inpatient or outpatient treatment. And we had a repeat offender task force to look at how to address it, because while we have twice as many first-time offenders in DWI as everybody else combined, we do have people with 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 offenses. And what this task force came up with was the most important single thing we could do to address that repeat offender category was to make sure they got a serious crack at treatment. And again, you can be sure if you put everybody in that universe of drunk drivers who needs treatment, if you put them through a good treatment program, they're not all going to succeed. Maybe half won't, but you know, we're talking 250 fatalities from drunk driving in Minnesota alone each year. It doesn't take too much to make significant cuts into real savings of life and the medical expenses and the other costs that society incurs because of that. So I'd suggest that you look at the payback on all of these things, that 7-to-1 payback that RAND Corporation found in California. I'd suggest that, you know, when we talk about the costs of these programs, we might talk about the benefits as well. And these aren't the type of thing where you're talking a 8% return on your money or 10%. I mean, that's a 700% return on funding, on the money you put into it. And so I'd suggest we ought to keep in mind that when we talk about it. Well, how are we doing in these areas? Well, the fact that I have some examples to point to, and those are just three that I've seen statistics on the payback on, doesn't mean those are the only things. I think every state is doing a number of things. There are lots of nonprofit organizations that are stepping in and trying to address these issues. But there is a lot to do. And if we look at the whole child and what it takes to raise a child, nurturing, which in many cases may mean parenting skills. I can say from my own experience with Minnesota, we do a good job of that. We have an early childhood family education program available in virtually every school district in the state. And a large number, and this is not for low-income kids, this is meant for everyone. And teaching parenting skills when, well, first of all, kids don't come with an instruction manual, and it's not an automatic how you raise children, and a whole lot of people have gone through the education system without ever having learned parenting skills. And this program is one that people from every socioeconomic category have gone through 1 or 2 hours a week and have claimed great success in. And yet something has been new in the last several years there, but I think many states have tapped into parenting education. It's one of the key aspects of programs like Head Start as well. But the early childhood education, the parenting education, help with the nurturing children. There's a lot happening there. Healthcare. We talk about preventive healthcare and how much better that is. Well, most states now are doing something to make sure that every child has a chance for immunization, and more are going into children's health plan types of things so that low-income, usually low-income working parents have some way of giving health care to their kids. If you're on welfare, in most states, medical assistance picks up the bill, but it's the low-income working parents who have no health care for their kids. And providing that, well, we're not doing well in that, but there is health care needs, housing needs. The other day I was talking about a woman who came in when we were talking about homelessness, and the woman and her 13-year-old daughter, and the mother was talking about how she had to retrain her daughter to be a daughter again. And as I got the rest of the story, it was a painful story. The mother was homeless, living in a car for many months. She had a mental health breakdown at the time. Related to that or not, I don't know. I would suggest it's possibly related to living in a car for that long. She tried to kill her daughter and herself. Unsuccessfully, her daughter was 8 years old. She was sent into an institution for about a month or two, and when she came out, she and the daughter living alone. The daughter was trying to help her mother, an eight-year-old trying to raise her mother, or to help her mother through a time of crisis. And it suggests to me that while that child survived and the mother survived and seemed to be thriving very well, we could prevent a lot of problems by making sure, one, that kids have decent housing, and two, that people who need mental health coverage, that they should get that. I've never figured out why that's less important than physical health coverage that more and more people assume should be a right of people. But we go through all of these things, the healthcare, the housing, the nutritional needs, the nurturing needs, the education needs. So kids grow up mentally, physically, emotionally, so they get the education they need to help them mature. And you look at all these things in childcare for parents who are working when they can't afford childcare. You look at all the needs and you think, wow, there's a lot there that we need to be doing. I took a look at all of this and I had proposed a children's budget in Minnesota a few years ago on trying to address all of these issues, to invest in them. Oh, but that's awfully expensive and we can't do that. And when I ran for governor, I had suggested that maybe the programs, we have pretty clear evidence that they save money, we ought to invest in them. If we're not going to do it because it's the right thing to do, let's do it for selfish reasons, because it'll save us money. I was pleased this year, maybe it was partly driven by welfare reform and changes there, but the governor this year proposed and the legislature adopted full funding of our sliding fee child care system, a program where if you're, depending on what your income is, you're working not too much more than a minimum wage job, you have a couple kids that need child care, there's no way you can afford it, you're losing money faster than you're making it. And so it's a program that, based on your income, you contribute to your child care and the state picks it up on a sliding fee schedule. And that program had a 2-year waiting list in our largest county. You're trying to get off welfare, you get a job, and you tell the employer, okay, yeah, I could start. When can you start? Well, Monday or as soon as I get child care. Well, how long is that going to be? Well, there's a 2-year waiting list. It doesn't help you get the job. But this year, the governor proposed full funding for it, and the legislature adopted it, to get rid of those waiting lists. And it's expensive. But again, it's one of those investments that I think we ought to recognize. It's, in my mind, cheaper to pay child care costs than it is to have people on welfare because they can't afford child care. But I had proposed all of these things, and now we come into the fad mode. This year, child care in Minnesota was the fad. So we're going to provide child care to every low-income parent who's working and can't afford the child care. We're going to do it, and we're doing it now. And that's the right thing to do, so we're going to step in and help with that. But that's only one part of it. What about the health care? What about the nutrition? What about the educational needs, the intervention with the troubled families? Certainly, all of those things, there is help for all of those things in Minnesota. But again, as I say, in many cases, half or more than half of the families who need the help and who qualify don't get them because there's not the funding there. And so while there's the fad of this and the political talk, if you read campaign literature, if you watch TV commercials, you're never going to find a politician who says they don't believe in education or they don't care about kids. The politician's kissing kids is a image that we recognize. Politicians are always trying to show their love and concern for kids, but it's not always shown up in the agendas of the politicians and the political system later on. And how do you afford it? Let me throw out two ways of looking at it, one of which is the question of priorities. Washington State, like Minnesota, are both going through a major fight, and in both cases, in both states, we're on the verge of providing funding to a billionaire team owner, in both cases a billionaire with a sports team who wants the public to pay for a new stadium for him. And I'm not, there's no philosophical objection to the idea of government investing in those things. If the public feels that's an appropriate role of government, I don't particularly feel it is, but if the public really believes strongly that they want to do it, that's fine if we take care of the other needs first. And saying, well, $450 million for Minnesota taxpayers to pay for a stadium, that's nice. I'm a Twins fan. I'd love to see a stadium built for them too, but that's got to be the last priority, not these other things. And the other issue when we look at this, and again, if there's not a disagreement, which there probably is some disagreement, whether these things are wise investments that pay back, the other thing is, even if you have something that's a great investment, if you don't have the money to invest, how do you do it? Well, the one example I can show or point to of a society really investing wisely is our own country about 50 years ago now. Right after we had gone through a painful nationwide depression for a decade, and then snapped out of it at the time we jumped into a war where we dropped everything we were doing. Absolutely everything, rationed rubber and steel and everything else, and all our factories moved from making automobiles to military munitions, and the entire country dropped everything and did that. So we were broke right after World War II. We were broke, yet we decided we were going to invest in people. The GI Bill. You're going to get education, soldiers, as you come back to our country. We're going to provide millions of you with higher education. We're going to invest in housing. I mean, public, the federal housing loans, that took off. The housing industry took off 50 years ago. We invested in housing. We invested in education. And not only did we invest in our own people, which, again, I would argue is a wise investment yourself, but we invested in Europe. The Marshall Plan, in today's dollars, is well over $50 billion. Well over $50 billion for somebody else. And I would believe that most people feel what we did for Europe was wise. It helped them recover very quickly. It helped create democracies throughout Europe. It helped create great trading partners with us. We benefited from it in a number of ways, but I'm not sure that that's the primary reason we did it. We did it because they had a need and they had helped us, we had helped them, and we were friends and we tried to do it. But we were at the stage of a desperate time, and yet we intervened. We intervened to not only invest in our own country, but other countries as well. And so I think if we really are serious about the idea of investing in not just children, but people, we can look at the future in a much brighter way, and we can find the means to invest as we did at a time our country was broke. We can do it if we set our priorities straight, and I'd love to see us move forward that way. One final comment, then I'd like to open it up for discussion. And that is, last night, Sharon, the woman in the wheelchair, was asking about the federal budget deficit, which is higher than it's ever been in history in the past 15 years. It's quadrupled from well under $1 trillion to well over $3 trillion now, and we're talking about getting the annual deficit down so we don't keep adding to it. And she talked about what about that does to the next generation. And if we look back and where we are now and where we're going to be in the future, yes, we've saddled our kids and their kids with a massive debt. And we are also saddling them, and even as we're cutting the deficit, we're in many ways saddling them with a bigger deficit in terms of intellectual opportunities, in terms of healthy people, in terms of a good infrastructure. If we let our roads and other things deteriorate, I'd say the human infrastructure is the most important thing by far. But if we let that deteriorate, that's also a burden we're pushing to the next generation, because the investments we didn't make, the prevention we didn't do, means higher crime rates, it means more healthcare problems, it means more social services we're going to have to pay for down the road. And as we work to reduce the burden we put on our kids in the federal budget deficit, we should also be looking to decrease the burden we put on them in the human capital deficit that we're putting on them. And with that, I guess I'd like to open it up for discussion of the topic and maybe things you're seeing. I mean, Martha, you pointed out one earlier, but I mean, if you want to challenge this or whatever, move from there. But I think it is the moral and the economic responsibility of us, and you can use whichever excuse you want for doing it, we ought to do it.
I have a comment and a question, my name's Phil. I've raised four children in a town of 20,000 people. Two very successful children who were a doctor and marine biologist and a junior in high school honors student and a 13-year-old daughter. This has been a, quote, normal process of raising children. But this village has provided them with a place of worship, excellent schools, place to play soccer and softball and hardball and recreational facilities, and a lifestyle that you could say is normal. Where does the village start and where does the village stop? I at one time was a first aid squad member, so I was part of the village. I've never been a political party or councilman or any of that stuff, but where does the village interfere, and how large does it have to be? And I would think that I take your comments as being the village is the country, or the village is the state. But in a lot of the things you're saying, the federal government is the village. And I wonder, how do we get back to the smaller section being able to see, recognize, and remedy a lot of the things that you talked about?
Sure. Well, let me suggest, first of all, I'm not suggesting the village is the national or state government. And when I talk about public, well, a number of the initiatives I'm talking about, not all of them, but a number of the initiatives I'm talking about are government-funded programs. Most of them, government programs now are contracted out with nonprofits. And in terms of making sure we have a system that takes care of everyone, I'd suggest that our national success means that we should all care about people, not just in our own community, our own village, our own neighborhood, but also people in other states and elsewhere around the country. But that's not suggesting that I think everything should be done at a federal level. I don't. I would suggest that we have very clear evidence that smaller is better in terms of villages, in terms of community. The strongest academic evidence these days is not that smaller class sizes help, they do, but that smaller schools can have an even bigger impact on people. Why? Because everybody's known. They're not a face, they're a name, they're a person. They are recognized, they can't get away with as much, maybe. I don't know what it is, but I think that your comments are exact. 20,000 is a lot healthier sized community in my mind than a city of 3 million people. And the Twin Cities metro area and Minneapolis, St. Paul is about 2.25 million now. I like smaller communities. And you can somehow make up for that. St. Paul and Minneapolis, the cities themselves are broken up into neighborhood organizations. And some of the neighborhoods are very healthy and they have neighborhood programs. There's a big move now towards recognizing that while we've tried to do a lot of desegregation and other integration efforts in the schools through busing, that we've also got to recognize the value of having a neighborhood school, and maybe we should be doing more integration of housing and communities rather than forcing it in a way that's busing kids out of their neighborhood where they don't play with the same kids after school they have in school. I don't know if there's a simple answer to, but I want to let you know, I think that you're right that smaller communities are better, and it's a lot easier when everybody knows each other. And when you, a country of 260 or 270 million people like we have, you can't have everybody living in communities of 2,000 or 3,000, which might be ideal. Some wouldn't like it, but what you have to do when you get the cities of many million people, try and break it down into manageable chunks. And what I'm suggesting in terms of some of these initiatives, healthcare and other things, you can fund some of those at a national level, or even a state level is better than doing it necessarily location by location, but leave a lot of the implementation to it up to communities, up to smaller things. There is a lot of benefit in that sense in local control. And in all of this, the idea that it's going to be government stepping in and doing this, I'd be scared of that. I think we should all be a little bit concerned about what would happen if we were intruding on that. But when I say the public, I mean public institutions, including churches and nonprofits that are not government, but that are community things. And your kids were probably fortunate to have a healthy community, and they were fortunate to have that. And Holden is a wonderful, atypical but tiny community where everybody knows everybody, or there's always somebody ready to help. And
but the concept of brother's keeper, mm-hmm, is so foreign to so many people that it really strikes in the face of a lot of the things that you're saying. I mean, the neighbor's lawn that's not mowed doesn't get mowed by his neighbor because the other guy doesn't have a lawnmower. The neighbor bitches about it. Where do we get that sense of conscience in Brother's Keeper to work in It Takes a Village?
Philip, let me tell you what happened at my school, because the same type of thing happened. I'm in a neighborhood where the school's kind of in the middle. It's a walking school. No kids are bused in except for special need kids. We have housing projects across from the school, and all back around behind the school we have small 2 and 3 bedroom rental houses, or very small older starter homes. We've got about 500 kids at our school, and we go from pre-K to fifth grade. And we got a new principal a year ago, March, who is wonderful. She's really good. Last February, first of all, our school has been broken into 23 times within the space of 25 minutes. And then we had a lot of violence on campus. It started in the projects where people were shooting at each other in the projects, but then they'd run on the school campus thinking people wouldn't continue to shoot at them in school, and then they did. And we'd have lockdowns. And that upset, finally, that's what upset enough parents. And we've had kids killed in the street because they have no place to play, and you know, all kinds of things. I'm forever going to funerals of kids that I've had. It's, you know, in 6 years I've had 2 kids out of my own class, and several others injured severely. Finally, the parents, and the other thing is about half our parents don't speak English. In February, when we had the shooting incidents right in a row, for one thing, the city councilman for that area came out, probably partly as a publicity stunt, and maybe I don't take politicians seriously, but I think that was partly it. And it was in our school's auditorium, and the place was packed. It was packed, and the parents on their own then, and the councilman saw how serious the parents were about this. Since February, we've got gates around the school, and it looks like a prison. It looks terrible, but no one can run in as a place to escape. I mean, it's a sanctuary. We can lock the gates, and the kids, I don't know if we're locking people out or locking the kids in sometimes, but people can't just run on campus. The housing projects across the street have gotten fences, and they're putting in 24-hour security with a guarded gate and the gates that go up and down. Right now, you can't get into the projects without giving your name and your social security number. And if you don't live there, you have to say who you're going to go visit. And some of the people bellyached and moaned and groaned, and most of them said, hey, that's great. They used to have gangs of just kind of like teenage and 20-year-old unemployed people kind of standing around in the afternoon drinking and threatening kids and stuff. That's all gone because they didn't live there anyway. The parents in our school on their own have decided for next year they would like to have a uniform policy at our school and have called Target in different places, and there's a Minnesota place for you, and have gotten deals on uniforms, and some of our Hispanic families have gone to Mexico and gotten some uniform information. We're going to have uniforms next year. We've got, we're working on identity badges for people. If they're with the district, we have one anyway. Not that I wear mine ever. Not that I know where it is even. But, well, I mean, I have one. But anyone else who is on campus for even any reason will have a security badge. They've just been doing a lot of things in terms of, you know, well, kind of taking it into their own hands. And we're getting more parents out for volunteer things. We had elections at our school in the 1st of May and the 1st of June. And both times the election people said, boy, we can't believe what a difference. It's so much quieter. We've got a police substation now in the projects across the street since February. The rate of incidents has gone from 70 per week to about 15 a week. Now, still 15 incidences a week, and it's, you know, and it's like murder and different things. So it's still fairly high, but you're going down from 70. This has not cost anyone a whole lot of money to do it, but it's been basically the parents with the support of our principal and the councilman for that area who finally have had enough. They finally could not take it anymore. They said, you know, our children's safety is at risk. This is ridiculous. And we have, our school is kind of like this little oasis in the gang territory. And we've got a treaty with the gangs who will come on campus now. Don't ask how that happened, but they don't come on campus now. We've got pre-kindergarten for 60 kids. That include, that's a half-day program and includes a hot meal. We've gotten Parks and Recreation to come out and do a summer program. We've gotten free summer school that's going on right now, but I didn't want to teach it. I wanted to be here instead. We've got a parent institute that meets once a week. We've got English as a second language class for adults. Next fall, we'll be starting a GED class. It's from the parents who finally say, you know what? This is not going to happen. And my principal said, okay, come on, let's do something. And until we got to the point where the parents were willing to speak up and say, I care too much about my children and my neighborhood to let this happen, we couldn't do anything.
I'd like to take her example on your point, because I like your brother's keeper is not our societal norm. I mean, the church is countercultural, and when you ask how big is the village, well, clearly, yeah, who is my neighbor? And your neighbor, basically everyone's your neighbor in the Christian sense. And therefore we who believe we are our brother's keeper and we are to be taking care of our neighbors, how do we reach out and share that with others and convince others of the merit of that? Well, that's one example where I think nobody would say, oh, we wish, well, it's good that it got that bad so people start changing, but you're taking, in that case, a desperate situation, and I like the way you said the gates thing, and Vern Fiatta this morning was talking in his Bible study about fences. Are they, do we fence people out or in? But clearly, in a desperate situation, people are deciding, hey, we're in this together, and we better do it, if not for charitable reasons, for moral responsibility or obligation reasons, for self-interest reasons, we decide we better be our brother's keeper. I think you look at that example, and that's one from one person who happens to be here today, and I think we've all seen very positive things where people you don't expect to step in and fill a gap. Part of my faith is that I'm supposed to be trying to persuade other people to step in and fill in the gap, and I better be trying to do it myself. You're right, it's not the way society's moving, but we take it one person, one step, one day at a time, and try and get others to join and do the same thing, and working the same thing, because it
does
happen.
Except that the press doesn't care, because the only thing they print about our school is the test scores, the standardized test scores. And you know what? Those puppies are not moving upward. Now, we've only been doing this since, what, January, some of this. And our test scores are still in the basement. And that's the only thing that the public cares about. Why are your test scores so bad?
Kids are shooting each other.
These kids don't speak English.
But that change takes acute leadership. That's what it does. And fortunately, it sounds like it's all heading in the right direction.
But to keep it going, you know, I don't know how they're going to keep it going over the summer, how they're going to start it off in the fall.
Once it becomes a norm of the community,
they're
ratcheted up another notch.
It seems to me right now people are just excited and it's something new and they feel like they're, I hate to say empowered because it's such a cliche, but here are very poor people who are either living off of welfare or working at minimum wage jobs in the casinos, many of whom do not have a formal education, many of whom do not even speak English well. They feel like they're in the bottom rung, and finally they're taking some, they're moving, they got an award from JCPenney's, a Golden Globe Award. I don't know if they do it everywhere, but they do it in Southern Nevada. And they got $250 in this nice big plaque and a luncheon. These people, primarily women, but a few men, got so dressed up. It was they got a school bus, because a lot don't have transportation. They got the school bus. They were dressed up, hose and makeup. And these are people who usually wear cutoffs and slippers. And went to this luncheon for JCPenney's.
And they were proud of it, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Now when you talk about the size of the village, too, you couldn't orchestrate that from the federal government or a state government. I don't know if you could do it from a county or city government. You couldn't orchestrate those things. You can facilitate them, perhaps. You can encourage them. But it has to be individuals or a small group or a small village, and her village may be 5 blocks. How many years have you taught there?
I just finished my 6th year there.
And before this past year where some of these positive things started happening, has it been getting worse every one of the years, or was it bad when you started?
It was bad when I started. Some years, it's kind of... Las Vegas is the fastest growing city in the U.S., and so the school district is the fastest growing school district in the U.S., and they keep having to build new schools. And so we've gotten very overcrowded and had almost 800 students, and then they opened a new school and rezoned everything, and we're back down under 500, and I think that's been a real help. But and personally, I had a terrible year. I had a really tough group of kids, really some emotionally disturbed children, very violent, vicious children. So personally, I had a lousy year. But I'm going back next year just because I like the school. I really like her principal. I think she's wonderful. The staff is very strong. You either are committed to working in a place like that, or you say, this is baloney. I can't even do crowd control. I'm going to go someplace where the kids are white and rich.
A sense of, an example of the sense of how the village doesn't work is at school budget time, when it's time to vote for the school budget, the AARP hires buses to take senior citizens to the polls when everybody else is working in order to defeat the budget so that your children don't get the kind of things they need for their education in order to prevent the $100 a year increase in their taxes. That's frustrating.
You actually have AARP doing that sort of thing?
Yes.
There's,
it goes on everywhere. Yeah. This is a national campaign of theirs.
Well, I've seen Minnesota has an AARP chapter which is not active in Minnesota. They're active on national issues. And we have Minnesota Senior Federation, which I work closely with, which tends to be people who are, it's the low income version of AARP, and much more the brother's keeper type. And I know a lot of seniors who will write letters on behalf of the thing. I never had kids, or I had kids and mine have long gone from the school. And I don't like property taxes, but it's clearly there is a generational thing there where lots of older folks who don't have kids in school and haven't for years, they don't want to pay for a penny for the schools. But that's one thing where Minnesota, much of Minnesota, has been fortunate that a lot of, for every one of that type of folk who are trying to, what's in it for me? There are some others, of seniors and others, who are saying, you know, this is important for our community. This is important for all of us. In the long run, our property values go up because it's a good thing to have a healthy school system. But I agree with you. I mean, that's part of the greed and selfishness, and I don't want to attribute it all to that, because certainly I'd suggest property taxes, at least in Minnesota, are at least fair, most regressive form of taxation. And there are some low-income seniors, there are a lot of low-income seniors, but there's some low-income seniors who are getting taxed out of their housing. And I think that's a place where government should be facilitating a fair tax structure, one that's based on ability to pay. The wealthy retirees who can afford to, hit them one way or another. The low-income ones, I understand why they're upset, though it seems to be more often the wealthy ones than the low-income ones who complain.
In our city, it's a suburb of Minneapolis, we have block programs, and I don't know if your neighborhoods have that, but that's what's really brought our community together, I think, because we have one captain per block, and the police organized it, basically under the name of crime. So we're all, because so many citizens, you know, want to take care of the crime, but basically it's getting to know your neighbors. So we get together in the local park, and you know, one person is assigned per block to be in correspondence with the police if there's a break-in in that block, and the police just have to contact one person, and that person circulates the letter and communicates to everybody else what's happened in the neighborhood. And it's, I mean, I'm the block captain, and I've gotten contacted once or twice, maybe. It's not like it takes a ton of my time in my neighborhood, in your neighborhood.
Trying to be full-time job. But,
you know, basically what that's done is facilitate my knowledge of all my neighbors. I mean, I know them all, and we get together for a potluck every once in a while just to be together again. And we borrow things from our neighbors all the time because we don't have it, or we see they have a ladder. Oh, could we borrow that ladder? Maybe we're more verbal about it, I don't know. But people in our neighborhood do tend to share. I think people would come up and ask us for something if they wanted it. But we aren't very middle class neighborhoods.
And it's clearly lower crime rate than the core cities, much lower than the projects that you're across from. But the point of community things like that, in our case we had our community parks, pretty good park system. Our local one had been neglected for 20 years. There hadn't been many kids around there. There's a whole new crop of kids, and the neighbors organized together and got the city council to talk about some modest improvements there. And I know that, our neighborhood is clearly not the at-risk one, but in every community, I mean, it's not purely an income thing when you're caring about when it's the village. Is the village our community, or is it our neighborhood? Is it our block? It may be all of those, but the more you can tie people together, the better.
John, I don't know if it's a comment or a question, but with some of the cuts, I'm always kind of surprised that the public has little awareness of how much systems like the prison are going to become more of the village for a lot of people. Mental health is going to move much more into the jail and criminal justice system than it is anywhere else. And you know, the welfare system that we have in our military in this country is never commented on. And the financial burden to the public in terms of, you know, the criminal justice system is going to only, is on the rise. And we just never, there's never much of a observation about that in the media or anywhere else.
The people you work with, how many of them, I can't remember, you've told me twice now, and I can't remember the population you work with.
It's primarily heroin and people.
And so very heavy percentage of them are offenders. And
involved in crime to support their habit. Mm-hmm. Many are not also, but, the federal government cuts that went out for substance abuse this last year is is really affecting a lot of the people that I work with. I mean, the notion that addiction can end in 1 or 2 years for people and that's going to take care of it is, you know, kind of ludicrous.
So. When you talk about the prisons, and that's the ounce of cure, because the pound of cure, because we didn't pay the ounce of prevention.
Right.
And not to quote California all the time, but it's the biggest state and they've done the most stuff on it. But in 20 years ago, California spent, I think it was about 10% of its state budget on higher education and about 3% on criminal justice system, and their higher education system's been slipping. And crime costs have gone up significantly. They now, their correctional system, I think it was a year or 2 years ago now, it surpassed the budget of their higher education system. And I once heard, it was a good speech, I'm sure he's given the same speech over and over, but Jesse Jackson did something about, he was talking about 3 strikes you're out, how about 4 balls you're on? And ball one is a job training, one, ball two is help with this, ball three is this. And he talked about how you got to understand that some people, the first time they've ever been in a school without broken windows is the prison. And the first time they've ever had 3 square meals a day is in prison. And in Minnesota, I know I had about a year before I ran for governor, the current governor closed all of our schools for cold, which is, I've never heard that happen in Minnesota before. Once in a while, local school districts will, but hey, we're tough and we can take the cold is the theory behind it. But it was, and he actually picked the wrong day because the next day was colder still, and it was like 30 below instead of 25 below, and the wind chill was very strong. So it was not unwise to close the school, so it caused a lot of hassle for people who have no way to take care of their kids during the day. But I talked with an alternative school in St. Paul. It was basically American Indian students who had fell through the cracks and weren't making it in any other system. And the kindergarten teacher was telling me, this was several months after this, she was telling me that yes, their school was closed that day, but they came to school anyway, the teachers did, because they knew what was going to happen. They were right. A lot of the kids walked to school, some of them longer distances, very inadequate clothing. Why? Because the school lunch was the first good meal they would have eaten all weekend. I mean, after the weekend, it was the first good meal. And the mother was saying, yeah, a lot of the parents have, whether it's crack addiction or whatever, these kids were going to walk on the coldest day of the year when we stopped the buses because, you know, it's too cold, so the kids go in inadequate clothing because they want a good meal.
So. Governor Whitman has, Christy Whitman, New Jersey, has instituted 2 successful programs such as that, and one is 3 strikes and you're in forever, and 4 strikes, or 4 balls and we're going to help you on, and that is, if you're on welfare, you're going to work. Mm-hmm. And in order to be able to work, we're going to give you child care and subsidy and housing. And that stuff is working, but it moves slowly. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of guts to get out there in the front and try to make those programs work, because they are expensive.
That's right, they're expensive, and they will pay back if you do it right. In Minnesota, we've done our welfare reform, I've called it welfare reform light, because we got the right idea, but we're not doing it adequately. The child care is the one piece of the puzzle we've done well, but in the past, our welfare system is clearly, nationally, you couldn't design a worse system. And it encourages dependency, and while most people on welfare may not be able to hold down a job of a standard sort and support themselves fully, we haven't done anything to give them the encouragement to move the right direction. And it's a dual role, one of government. One is to give people the opportunities and the encouragement and support, and 2 is to expect people to fill in and take responsibility. But I dropped a welfare to work bill in several years ago that would have funded the health care and the child care and a couple other things, including job training, to make sure people moved into it. And there are a whole lot of people, a whole lot of welfare recipients who wanted to and couldn't make ends meet, and they'd keep bouncing in and out as they'd fall through, child care would fall through, they'd go back on welfare. And so I think our old system was bad. I'm concerned that in many states, Minnesota included, we're setting it up for failure by not doing it. And you're right, it is expensive initially, though it's a lot cheaper to have people working.
And it takes guts to put it in place.
One of my biggest concerns is I see children labeled so often, and it's not only in the education system, but we're all guilty of it. Had instances where our son, for instance, he's in sixth grade, and there was an instance in the school where another child, a special needs child, had accused our son Matt and a couple of his friends of name calling. And someone that was watching over the children on the school ground came and literally grabbed them by their collars and said, "Now, are these boys troublemakers?" And when she found out they weren't troublemakers, oh, well, it's okay. You know, it was threatened he was going to get a green slip, pink slip, or whatever. But once he wasn't a troublemaker, you know, it smoothed out, and they believed him. You know, and I think had he been a troublemaker, he wouldn't have had a chance. He would have been guilty. It wouldn't have mattered if it happened or not. And it really concerns me, because I think a lot of these kids, they're from tough families, and I want to see them have hope. Yeah. I want to hear them that it doesn't matter what you've been through, you can be a successful person. And success doesn't mean having a corporate job. I mean, there's successful janitors. There's, you know, success comes in all areas of life. And we tend to build up that success is if you have fancy cars, a nice house, this, that. And so these kids that are thinking, if I attain that, I'll be successful, and they're like, heck, I'll never have that. I'll never be anybody. You know, and
or they won't gain it through legal means.
Right.
Well, yeah. In Las Vegas, you can have a fancy car.
You can sell drugs and make $5,000 in a minute.
Yeah. And so what are we telling them that success is in our education system?
And just speaking from the example of our own kids' school, you can clearly see that a lot of teachers who have a lot going for them, who are good teachers in many ways, are, as you said, each one of us does this, guilty of this. We tend to label people. And the kids who are successful anyway, they get all the rewards. Our school, we've been trying to fight a number of times. Oh, good behavior rewards. Well, I want kids to do good behavior because it's the right thing, not because they get some prize for it. And likewise, the kids who are having troubles, sometimes the thing they need more than anything is a pat on the back and some encouragement. You're doing a good job. And the labeling, I mean, my point earlier, which I think Martha pointed out as well too, is that we can recognize these kids are going to fail. And the teachers who are at the toughest schools with the most troubled kids wouldn't be there if they didn't want to turn that around, but society isn't necessarily filling in everything else. I've seen one of the schools in our community where one of the tougher schools and more at-risk kids, teacher who saw one of her kids a lot of teachers cringe when they see what the homes these kids are going back to. They know what's happening, and they know the kid is worse the next day, and whether it's abuse of some form or neglect or what the problem is. This one teacher in the end took in his foster care, which is highly irregular, took in his foster care one of her students a year later. And you hate to see it. The stereotyping and, oh, that's the trouble with kids. Oh, you don't give them a second chance, is it?
Well, and the children that have overcome, the stories you hear of success are usually because there was someone in their life that really believed in them and that gave them hope. And then
the other thing that I think is really valuable, and there's more and more evidence of the value of it, and that is that as kids help others, as people, true of us too, when we serve somebody else, we feel good about it. It makes us healthier. You don't have to have somebody say thank you to realize what I did was good. And Minneapolis Public Schools, they started several years ago a summer program for the at-risk kids who are in summer school because they're falling through the crack, they're struggling in school, they're failing classes. And as all of those programs, it's really hard to get kids to attend. The attendance rate is terrible. But this, what they call a walkabout program, they take high school juniors or seniors, kids who are in the program as high school kids who are failing, and they bring them in and help these failures tutor fifth graders who are also troubled kids. And they have the combination of them go out and do some projects as part of their summer school. If it's math remedial stuff, they do something in a nursing home with people, and they do, somehow they try and tie it to math. But most of the time is nothing to do with math. Most of the time is the older kids helping the younger kids and the younger kids helping somebody else in the community. And they found out not only did they come to school more during summer school more, but they actually did better in the summer school, and it paid off the following year. Their attendance remained better. And that's one vignette of, I think, the idea that the more we help and serve others, for our own mental and emotional well-being, the more we serve, the more we benefit. And giving kids that chance of succeeding, I think, is ties in partly with what you're saying.
And the best success rate we can have of all is at 5 years, if they come from a very well-balanced home atmosphere for the first 5 years, and then they're partnered up with a school atmosphere where they're, again, conditioned to be good citizens and have good values, your chances of that success rate are so wonderful. But how you look at the parents, blame the schools blame the parents, it's a partnership. It's the two working together.
That's the village. I mean, that's the parents.
That's the village.
And it's to the extent the churches can be, the churches involved, community groups.
There's going to be bad parents. Yeah. There's going to be bad school systems. It's the matter of putting the best of the best together.
Get
it's
everything we can.
Be the result.
The other night, Sister Rosina, I don't know how many of you have met her who's here this week, she was talking about how she intervened in New York City on, I think, subway, while waiting for a subway to go home one night. She saw a little 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old kid, I don't know how old, who was crying desperately for the mother, and the mother was, it must have been 2, 3-year-old kid, because she said the mother was like 15 or 16. She was talking to her sister, this is 11 at night or 10 at night, and just totally ignoring it. It was clear from people around there later that the kid had been standing there, the mother had been standing there for an hour or so, and the kid was just crying. She was just telling the kid to shut up, and what kind of failure, and you're going to be as bad as your dad, or as a failure like your dad if you don't shut up. And Sister Rosina stepped in, and she started scolding the mother. I think most of us couldn't do it if we wanted to, but her personality and her style was such, and that's wrong. Well, you should be in bed, and your kid should be in bed too. And quit ignoring your kid. That kid is not going to be a failure. If it is, it's because you're making him one. And she intervened in a way that I think most of us would be uncomfortable with. But she's saying, you know, if this mother's not going to take the responsibility, somebody else has to. And after the mother, grumbling, took her kid and went home, the other people waiting for the, waiting around there were saying how, oh, this has been going on for a long time. Thank you for saying something, and thank you for doing this. But it is the village, and we can't all play her role, but other
ways. We discussed that in our church. What do you do when you see a situation like that?
Basically, we better call this quits. I forgot the time. I'm sorry.
No, I've got to release recruits.
We'll call the tape off for the
Sister Rosina had.
Thank you, Phil.
She said that, you know, if we have the Spirit of Christ living in us, we do not need to be afraid. And she says, I'm here today, and if I die tomorrow helping somebody out, then that's in God's plans, and it's in God's hands. And she says, you need to be bold in the Spirit and do it. And she is so bold, and just the way her presence is that way.
And as Christians, we do need to be bold, and it's so hard for us because we never want to feel like
we're
part of our American society.
Especially the Scandinavian heritage. It's like, put up that front.
Don't let
anybody see any cracks in your facade.
I also think,
while you're here,
during that talk the other night where she was commenting on that, some woman from Duluth, Minnesota, was talking about how she saw some kids throwing rocks at cars or something. And while she was driving somewhere, and she realized, you know, that's outrageous. So she slammed on the brakes, backed up, and went out and lectured the kids. And they stopped
and dispersed.
and I was going to say, I give her a lot of credit, but I'm not sure that everyone should try. As a male, I'm not sure that would be a good idea. They may take that as a challenge.
Right.
And in her city of Duluth, Minnesota, a big scan a couple years ago, and teenage kid, early driver, bumped.
That's right.
At a stoplight, bumped another car. The five kids got out, chased him down, and murdered him.
Yeah.
And Duluth.
That's her own city, and she stopped and backed up the car and did that. And we may not all be able to do it, but there are times when we just kind of, well, I don't want to interfere.